heard about the reorganization. And basically, bioengineering and chemical engineering were combined along with environmental and transport systems to make CBET. Chemical, bioengineering, environmental, and transport systems. That's the division that I'm in, is CBET. And you can see the other combinations. They tried to take a lot of programs and combine them into a smaller number. Now, within the engineering directorate, you can see that currently we have five divisions, and CBET being the one in the middle, and I highlighted it with red. And then there are other funding mechanisms. In fact, a lot of my research funding as a professor has been through CMMI, or used to be CMS, Civil and Mechanical Systems, and now it's Civil Mechanical Manufacturing Innovation, which funded biomechanics. So a lot of my research was in biomechanics. Now, within CBET, there are four areas of concentration. There's chemical engineering, there's transport, thermal fluids, then there's bioengineering and engineering healthcare. And RAPID falls under that category. So there are three program officers that work inside that group, and research aid persons with disabilities is, I've just taken over that responsibility from Bob Yeager. So you can get an idea of where RAPID fits into the overall NSF picture. Now, enhancing opportunities for persons with disabilities is the future endeavor because we want to increase the numbers of persons with disabilities in the workforce, in the STEM workforce, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, which is what NSF is funding. That's really consistent with the CBET mission. The CBET mission basically states, without reading the whole thing, we want to develop a diverse, globally engaged workforce. And then again, this is STEM. This is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, which is what NSF funds. Now, the national goals of RAPID, first of all, to provide the assistive technology that's required by the ADA. And these are other programs, the New Freedom Initiative, No Child Left Behind. Providing opportunities for persons with disabilities to actually be fully engaged in education and ultimately in the workforce. This was an interesting slide. Again, this is one that there are basically two approaches that RAPID takes. One is to fix the person, and the other is to fix the environment. And notice the quotes. When my wife saw this slide, she looked over my shoulder last night when I was working on this. She said, fix? What do you mean by fix? So it might come up with a better word. But the director of NSF, and I think this is pretty much the prevalent philosophy, is if you're broken, let's fix you. Let's use technology to fix you, as opposed to adapting the environment or adapting technology so that it allows you to integrate as opposed to being fixed. So I think that's the direction that we're going into. But, you know, we're in a transition period, and that transition period is significant. I would say we're 50 years behind other underrepresented groups in transitioning into mainstream. We're 50 years behind the ethnic groups within the United States. We're 50 years certainly behind women being accepted as scientists and engineers, and we haven't reached that stage of militancy yet. Although, I don't know if many of you listened to Judy yesterday, or was it yesterday or Friday? Friday. I didn't get a chance to listen to her talk, but I've heard her talk before, and Judy has reached the militancy stage. So, and that's important. I think that's an important stage to go through. Currently, if you go online to the National Science Foundation, and I don't think I actually put the website up here, it's www.nsf.gov. It's very simple. You can go through, it's got a simple a menu. You can go through to engineering and then to CBET and then ultimately see what the opportunities for funding are. And right now the PD 08-5342. Now 5342 is the RAPID program. The next funding cycle is going to be August 15th through September 15th. We receive proposals twice a year. So the next funding cycle will be August 15th through September 15th. It's important that you look to see what the new initiatives are. Recent interests are neuroscience and neuroengineering. BCI, brain-computer interface, is a very hot topic right now. NSF, the bioengineering group, has funded a national and an international conference. I think it was back in 2006 on BCI. That's a real hot area. Also, rehabilitation robotics is another really important area. What we do not fund is incremental improvements. We've got something, there's a lot of work that's been done, but then to get to the next stage, if it's just a small incremental change, we like to look at the big picture. How do we really infrastructurally change some aspect of the engineering environment with respect to disability? So we're looking at big jumps and not small incremental jumps. And we're looking at innovation beyond the frontiers of current knowledge, which is pretty standard. Now, we also fund, the RAPID program funds undergraduate design programs for universities. I actually ran two of these programs not funded by NSF when I was at the University of Central Florida. I did it for 4 years. I was leading the senior design program at the University of Central Florida in mechanical engineering, and I didn't know that this funding was available, which I should have known. This was back in 2000. But these projects have to have a meaningful design experience for the students, so it's usually a capstone design curriculum that the students have to experience. Appropriate level of quantitative engineering analysis so that they have to really use, for example, in the design methodology, you go from conceptual design to parametric design to design for manufacturing. You have to go through all of these steps with respect to a RAPID funded project as well. And then you have to propose 10 possible projects. Now, this is for a 5-year period, so you would actually have students working on 2 projects a year for 5 years, and you propose these projects. And obviously, they can change in years 3, 4, and 5 as they evolve, but they still have to have the fundamental components with respect to design and design methodology. Now, one of the things that I think is extremely important, and I'll reiterate this, the end user absolutely has to be, well, I shouldn't say absolutely, has to be involved where possible. I had my students work directly with students with disabilities, and these students were not disabled. My engineering students were not disabled, but they worked directly with students with disabilities to find out what abilities were there and then how to adapt those abilities through assistive technology to perform various tasks, which I'll show in a few minutes. Here's one project that RAPID did fund back in 2003, where a group of sailors who were all disabled actually sailed, was it from Hawaii to San Diego or from San Diego to Hawaii? To Hawaii. And it was a race, and they actually came in they were in the top 20% that actually arrived. So they did very well. I listened to the presentation. Actually, the captain of this group gave a presentation at the what's it called? No, it wasn't the ICDR. It was downtown at the press club. The press club. He gave a presentation. NSF had sponsored it, and he said it made him feel really good when their sail had the wheelchair sign on it, and they're cruising along and they're passing all these ships of total able-bodied persons, and it said it was really demoralizing for them as well. But students at San Diego State actually made adaptive technology, assistive technology, so that the various disabilities could be accommodated on board this sailing vessel. And we got to see some of that adaptive technology, seats that would actually move around, so a person who is mobility impaired can sit in the seat and still move around the ship and get things done inside the sailing vessel. So it was very innovative on many, many levels. The captain was blind. which was an interesting experience as well. And he was a great speaker, excellent speaker. And he really, the thing that they, he said that they had to do was not take themselves too seriously. Their project was very serious, but they didn't they had a lot of fun on the ship, and they really enjoyed coming in the top 20 in the group. Here's another assistive technology project that I actually had my students work on. This was one of the first ones where we had a young woman, Shauna, who was severely disabled. She was blind, deaf in one ear, confined to a wheelchair, had high spasticity. So my students had to, and she wanted to work in a library at an elementary school. So my students first had to determine what type of ability she did have. She had some gross motor control in her right hand. So they, in working in the library, she wanted to check books in and out for the students and maintain the inventory for the library. So my students developed this scanning technology to scan the barcodes on the books, and Shauna could hit this, we call it this big red button, with her hand, and she could hit the button, and the scanner would go across and actually scan the field and get the barcode so she could maintain the inventory. So the students got used to going up, and here's the scanner. There's a lot of internal parts in this thing, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And unfortunately, I don't, this was a video, and I don't have the corresponding movie with it, but it just shows that this thing scans. That's Sean in the background. So it scans across. The students actually started seeing her as a person they had to work with in order to check a book out, and didn't see her as this person with a disability anymore. They would come in and say, Sean, I'm ready to check out. She would hit the button, the scanner would go across, and they saw her as an integral part in the library activities. So it wasn't just performing or allowing her to be employed by the library, it was changing the paradigm of the students as well, which I thought was probably more important than the technology that my students were able to develop. Now, with any kind of moving part, this was a screw mechanism because it scanned across a field, you're going to have a lot of fatigue failures. So the next generation of students came, or the next year, they developed this mirror technology. Now, we had some focal issues we had to deal with, but they were able to only have a rotating bar as opposed to this big screw mechanism and have this thing move across. So the students, again, got a lot of education from this experience, and the library was able to employ Shauna, because when this machine was down, they couldn't keep her on. So we really had to worry about the fatigue life of the system. Now, other funding opportunities that RAPID is affiliated with is SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research, and again, human-computer interface, education applications, and you can contact Ian Bennett. And you can go online with NSF, search SBIR, and see what the SBIR activities are. And these are some of the SBIR programs: assistive technology, cognitive learning, working with the physically disabled. Question? Oh, thought I heard a question. And, of course, the human-computer interface. Another funding opportunity that RAPID is affiliated with is Emerging Frontiers in Research and Innovation. This is actually within the Engineering Directorate, and there's this is real cutting-edge activity. So it's Emerging Frontiers. And Zoe Rastigar is the program officer. Actually, I think he's a division director? Is he a DD or is he? Yeah. Well, he's the one you want to contact for this. So Zoe Rastigar is I've known him for many, many years in bioengineering, and he's really very supportive of innovative research. And then we have the BRIDGE program, Broadening Participation Research Initiation. Grants in engineering. The deadline, the past deadline was February 8th for 2008. I think this is an annual.
The last I heard, you want to talk to Mary New Hospital.
Yeah.
I heard they want to do this every year.
Okay, right. So this was an 07, and you can tell by the NSF announcement, the 07-589. 07 means that the request for proposal came out in 07. And I have not seen the 08 yet. So be on the lookout for that. And this is a 24-month award with $175,000 in total costs. And it's to promote this participation in research activities. And Judy, or Mary Juhas, is the, and I'm still learning names in the new directorate, she's in charge of the broadening participation program within the engineering directorate. And then the interagency partners, the VA, NIH, Department of Education, and FDA, there's a lot of interagency activity. And then there's the Interagency Committee on Disabilities Research, ICDR, which is 14 agencies, is that correct? Or more? Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Well, I keep looking to Bob because I've been out of the loop for 2 years. I represented NSF in the ICDR, and then now that I've been out of the system, I'm trying to, I don't want to talk, give you information that's 2 years old. The future buzzword in RAPID is transformative, the transformative activities that you want to get funded. Some of the RAPID challenges, and I know I'm probably going way over, so I need to cut this short. Success rates need to be higher. Right now, we're at about a 10% success rate. I don't want to discourage you from submitting proposals. I talked with the division director, and we're trying to get more money into the RAPID program, which is going to make our success rates go up. The funding levels for restorative research and fundamental engineering should also be higher. And again, that's that transformative activities. Collaboration with target beneficiaries, I think, is essential. Persons with disabilities have to be involved. How do you design for a group if you don't have any input from that group with respect to the needs of that group? So, and I don't want to say that group, us. How do we actually make a difference? I know crutches pretty well. I know coefficients of friction between rubber and various floor surfaces pretty well. You know, and persons who have normal shoes and walk with a normal gait don't even think about it, because floor surfaces are designed with a particular type of coefficient of friction where you have a bipedal walking gait. But crutches, you have a much higher stress because you've got a smaller area with the same load. Anyway, I'm not going to give you an engineering lecture. And again, why should persons with disabilities be included in broadening participation? Because there's talent embedded in all of us. You can't judge a book by its cover. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. So obstacles create big challenges and great opportunities. Here's another slide from Alaska. These two seals were just out sunning themselves on this iceberg as I floated by in the boat. And so I said, well, that looks pretty cool. And it was. So one final thought. And you'll see my perspective here. In 1980 or 1968, we all remember Star Trek and Captain Pike, who was in some kind of Delta ray poisoning, and so he was severely disabled. He's in this wheelchair that's kind of surrounds him, and the only way he could communicate was to one beep for yes and two beeps for no. I think it might have been the other way around, and that little flashing yellow light. Now, that was assistive technology in the 23rd century as envisioned in 1968. So, if most of you remember the story, Mr. Spock, who was his first officer at the time when he was poisoned, they had gone to Talos IV with these, you know, people with big heads who could really tap into your neural system and get what your dreams were. These Talosians were able to provide direct neural assistive technology so that Captain Pike could live out the rest of his life on the planet. And the whole thing was Spock was in trouble and so forth. I'm sure you remember the program. But he lived out the rest of his life on this planet through his neural thoughts, through his thoughts of what he wanted to do. He was still encapsulated in this body that didn't work, but there was this person inside that was able to come out and live the rest of their lives, you know, fulfilling all of their goals and interests. Now, that's fiction. That was Star Trek. This is reality. And many of you may be familiar with Gemma Leach. She was the person of the week April 4th of this year on ABC. Every Friday they have a person of the week. Gemma is 10 now. When she was 8, and she has fairly severe cerebral palsy. She has no oral communication skills. She's confined to a wheelchair. But she won the Education Supplement Right Away competition out of 1,600 contestants. Now, she uses a touch screen, or she used a touch screen, and her mother would hold her hand, and she would touch the screen with a stick with a ball on the end of it and write. And this is just an excerpt from one of her essays. She said, "Many people can't imagine how there could be a brain in this body. They see a broken child like a broken toy. Simpler to dispose of than used for the few things it can still do. Few people suspect a city of people lies inside my fractured casing, with artists, musicians, politicians, teachers, priests, and spacemen all vying with each other for airtime on Gemma FM." Now, this is a little girl who's, you know, she wrote this when she was 8 years old. This is the reason we do what we do. We have to provide the technology so that the talent that's embedded in a broken body is able to flourish, able to not just perform the basic functions, but to flourish and evolve. Because of her being on the ABC Person of the Week, one of the computer companies, and it's probably Apple, provided her with a heads-up display so she can actually write now by just looking at the letters on the screen. And she sees herself as a budding writer. So this is an old medieval salutation. Some of you may be familiar with it. Farewell, and I hope you live long enough to be disabled. And that's my contact information. Any questions? Should we wait for questions after? Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. That's a good question. That depends. I was told last week that right now we have 4% of $97 million. So that's less than $4 million. It's not a lot. But, again, I'm trying to work to increase that budget. And there are mechanisms that are in place for doing that.
Calm reason and a bit of cynicism.
Okay, can you hear me? Good morning, all. I'm going to very briefly talk about NIDER's gestalt, and then I'm going to focus in on one of our grant programs, the field-initiated program. Just for those of you who are not as familiar with us, we have a mission that's very broad, and it's simply to generate new knowledge and promote its effective use to improve the abilities of people with disabilities to perform activities of their choice in the community, and also to expand society's capacity to provide full opportunities and accommodations for its citizens with disabilities. Very broad, important to keep that in mind in terms of the field-initiated program. Our mandate, our work, covers cross-disability, physical, sensory, psychiatric, cognitive. We also cover the lifespan, from infancy through aging and not yet beyond, but up to that point anyway. And this is an exciting aspect of the field-initiated program in that we are able to pull out areas and populations that are not necessarily as well served in other parts of NIDER's portfolio. Much as our mission is broad, we cover the domains of life, employment, participation, community living, health and function, disability demographics, which is one of my pieces, and of course technology for access and function. And I'm sure around here over the past couple of days you've been to sessions with some of our grantees, perhaps in the in rehabilitation engineering and research centers. Those are major parts of our portfolio. Now, we run on a 5-year plan. Our upcoming plan, at this point, we are looking at putting a little bit more focus on reducing barriers and enhancing facilitators leading to improved employment outcomes. Let me, for those of you who might have heard some scuttlebutt in the field that NIDR is moving away from funding a range of opportunities and focusing solely on employment, that's not the case. When you think about it, every other aspect of our portfolio is important to helping improve the capacity of individuals as well as the capacity of society to facilitate employment. Our current plan, the outcome is participation in community living. Ultimately, employment is an important component of that. Okay, I mentioned the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Centers. Of course, we have other major funding mechanisms, the Rehabilitation Research and Training Centers, Disability Rehabilitation Research Projects. These are grant programs in which we essentially define the outcomes we want you to achieve. So they're targeted, if you will. Our open programs for you to come to us with a great idea, certainly the Small Business Innovative Research Program, currently managed by Dolores Watkins, who I believe is preparing to retire, as seems to be the case with so many at NIDR. With any of these grant programs, by the way, if you want further information, drop me an email or give me a call. We've had a lot of transition at NIDR over the years. The so-called brain drain in the federal government. But we're bringing in new people to manage a lot of these programs. Let me talk to you a little bit about the Field Initiated Program. And I know a couple of our grantees, a couple of my Field Initiated grantees are in this room, Marcia, Kathy, there might be others. So if you want more information about how do I write a successful Field Initiated proposal, buttonhole them. You know, you can certainly call me and I can give you lots of general tips and information, which I'll do some of now, but they've been through the mill. They know how competitive it is. And it is competitive. Ted mentioned roughly a 10% for the programs there. In a good year, we fund 10, 11, 12% of the grants, the applications we receive. Couple years ago, it was more like 6%, and the year after, it was 7%. Part of that is the number of applications we receive per year. Sometimes it's a couple hundred, sometimes it's over 300. Part of that, unfortunately, is our funding situation. We used to fund 30 or so. That was back in the day when Bob Yeager was at NIDR, and he had some graying hair through this program. Well, the past couple of years, we funded 20, 22, 23. It's unfortunately the case with a program like this. It's important to us, but the reality is when we have continuing grants that we want to fund, when we have new priorities that we want to fund, we need to find a little money someplace. One less field-initiated proposal. This year, we're funding, for FY08, we're funding 20. A lean year. I can tell you that the announcement, the field initiated announcement for the next fiscal year will be coming out in the summer with a 60-day turnaround time on proposals. So you'll keep an eye on the Federal Register, or again, you drop me an email, david.keer, K-E-E-R, at ed.gov, ed.gov. Drop me an email and I'll make sure that the right person gets you on the list to be notified of the announcement. The field-initiated program has been very good over the years for people doing technology research, particularly assistive technology. Roughly a third of the awards over the past 6-7 years have been in the technology domain, another third in health and function area. Of course, there's always some overlap there. We fund fewer awards in the area of employment than we'd like to see. For those of you who might be involved in employment research or technology for employment, keep that in mind. Write us a good application. And that is the most important piece of what you have to do as an applicant to this program. We do not look at these applications per se and make the decision. We rely very heavily on our peer reviewers. Okay, so you are writing to the peer reviewers, and you're writing to them through the specific selection criteria that we publish. It's heartbreaking. This is so competitive. We're talking sometimes a couple tenths of a point is the difference between funding and not funding. And you have to take every one of the selection criteria seriously, very seriously. Particularly, don't overlook things like evaluation or staffing or whatnot. Make sure you address everything in your proposal. By the way, those of you who are not planning to apply in the near future, we'd be happy to have you submit a CV and a letter of interest to serve as a reviewer. Again, you can send that to me. That's david.keer, K-E-E-R, at ed.gov. I'm not running for political office. I'm not going to ask you for money, but that's my email address. Types of output, types of projects we funded, the gamut. Some of the more interesting things we funded over the past several years, accessible aquarium exhibits, digital cinema, accessible in-flight services, home media center with voice output, image manipulation, life skills management systems, life skills software, patient lifts and transfer devices, and on. So again, it runs the gamut. And some of the most exciting research we find in the technology area comes through this program. It's $200,000 a year for up to 3 years. The $200,000 is total. As with the NSF grant, that includes both the direct and the indirect. Nonetheless, it's an opportunity, as Kathy can tell you, it's an opportunity. You basically got money for a seed project, which then can blossom and become something fantastic and lead you to a new career line. It's also an opportunity, if you're looking at a program, if you're developing a new program or a technology. We don't fund services, per se, but we do fund research about services. We fund research about new programs to provide services, so keep that in mind as well. That's the gist of it. This SBIR program, as you know, you have to be a small business, per se. You can't be an academic unless you happen to have a small business on the side. I believe the current amount is $50,000 to $75,000 for the first year. And then, of course, there's a phase two, which is a couple of years beyond that if you're successful with your first phase. And that's my spiel, and I'll be happy to take any specific questions or general questions later. Absolutely, and let me a little more detail on that, which I meant to do. We use, for the field-initiated program, as for our SBI program, we use a standing review panel, courtesy of Bob. We started doing this in 1999, and over the years, we've refined it, and it's been a pretty effective panel. We currently have 7 reviewers per panel. In any given year, there will always be new reviewers to the panel because of the way terms rotate. The panel includes people from academia, people involved in technology service delivery, consumers, people involved in service provision. So yes, it includes both the designers, if you will, and the end users. We're very conscious of that with all of our grant review programs. That includes them together. In any given year, we've been funding about, roughly over the past 7 years, about a third of the grants have been in the development area, and the rest have been in the research area. And that has nothing to do with an internal bias at NIDR. I think sometimes it has more to do with how well the proposals are written. What I can say is that on June 4th, we called the successful applicants. The other applications we're preparing to mail out the comments now.
Okay, I think I want to stop there. Thank you, Dave.
Sure.
And our next speaker is Lou Cofrano. I've known him for quite a while. Another stalwart Fed here that is devoted to seeing that worthy applicants get funded. And appreciate your coming out here today. And, you know, could I mention that Lou has additional insights? And now he's looking, what do you mean? He's been detailed for quite a while to Dr. Giannini's office on disability. And I think right now, if I had to pick a Fed in government that probably knew more about disability research and health and human services than Lou.
I think that's a little overstated, but that's fine. Dr. G's perspective. All right. Let me quickly sort of mention a few things in terms of the center and NIH, because as you know, as our chairman here has represented, things are changing. Things are changing not only in the government, but also in NIH, too, because of a lot of transitions going on in a way of thinking about science. One of the things I'd like to do when I'm starting here is recognize one of my colleagues from CSR, Joe Pelham, who's rightfully so next to one of the peers supporting the building here. And if you have questions about review, hopefully she'll help me out in terms of keeping us accurate and up to date on that. Welcome, Joe. What I've done is I've handed out two items. One item is a one-page description of staff in the center, and that indicates people, plus their emails, plus where they're located. The other thing I've handed out is a newsletter, which is coming around one side of the room, which comes out sort of, comes out two or three times a year and sort of highlights different things at the center and also different things that are going on at NIH that people in this community might be interested in. What I'd like to do is focus on just a couple of items that the center is doing that should be of interest to this particular, I guess, constituency at this point. We do work in the area of engineering in terms of some support for devices and so forth, but with the, I would say, with the recent growth of another center at NIH, the NIBIB, they really do a lot of the fundamental research, and we're more into that transformation stage where we're looking at the clinical sort of interface of what these devices, quote-unquote, can do for people and how they make a difference. What is it, a significant difference, a clinically significant difference in terms of health, or just a significant difference in terms of their having functional mobility? So in reference to that, we had an announcement a couple years ago that listed for R01s, and unfortunately the response to that was fairly good, but the results in terms of review was dismal, and there's a number of reasons for that. And the only reason I mention that is that announcement, which is going to be a program announcement, will be relisted, and it'll be relisted as a R13. And if you're familiar with the NIH parlance, and R13 is a meeting grant. And basically, this is the way, for example, you can have a meeting to get ready for a large clinical study. So what it does is it gives you money for you to bring together investigators that are from these different groups, basically, to talk about their different parts. So when you do get ready to submit an R01, it's cohesive. You just don't have names and roles specified, but there's some parts there in terms of protocol and some agreements. I think one of the things that we've learned, and I think the two previous speakers have sort of highlighted that, is we're taking, which should be familiar with engineering, a systems approach, that when you have a device, there's a lot of different aspects to that that you have to look at and to sort of integrate that into a package that makes some sense from a research perspective is important. Now, the second thing I'd like to talk about that should be of interest to people here is there'll be a meeting at NIH on July 23rd, 2008, in the Natcher Auditorium on the NIH campus. And it has to do with pediatric devices and what's needed for the field and how to best meet those needs in terms of things. Now, if you're familiar with what's happened in the pharmacology area in terms of drug development and so forth, many of those drugs that are developed for older populations. And then what they do is they say, well, for children and so forth, what you do is you make adjustments in the dosage. And as you all know, that doesn't necessarily work. And so in this instance, again, what they're looking at is in terms of devices, because there's a lot of devices, as there is with the concern of this aging population, of which I belong, that they're going to need assistance in some way. And, you know, we think of that in terms of mobility devices or other types of things. But in doing that, there's an emphasis on that. But there's also a thought that what about all the children now? And you could go into the details about all the children that are born early and the deficits that they're going to have, whether they're cognitive, physical, in terms of mobility and so forth over the years. And the real question there is how do you, again, develop the devices or other types of things that are needed to make those people able to contribute to society, as, again, some of the other speakers have addressed, which is the idea of we have a lot of talent in this country, and it should be appropriate that everyone have an opportunity to contribute. And so that's the concept, is to look at those things so that they can do that. Now, the only other thing I can say, again, is there is an orientation at NCMRR towards clinical research. And also there's going to be, in the past, we have supported, as I mentioned, a lot in the engineering area and some other areas. But I think now there's a, with those things, we're not going to eliminate or not do those, but we're going to look at those. But we're trying to promote things in community integration or community research for individuals with disabilities. We're also looking at issues relative to behavioral types of things that we haven't really capitalized on a lot of research expertise that's been out there in different areas to contribute to those, I think, those areas. So that I'll stop there and then maybe answer some questions if there are some questions, or defer to Joe Pelham if they're concerning review.
The question was the timeline for the R13 grant that you mentioned. You said it was going to be reannounced or something.
Right. It should be out within the next couple of months. It's been submitted and so forth, and it should be out in the next couple of months. But it's something, again, it's not a set-aside, but it is an announcement that indicates that there will be this opportunity that at least the center is interested in. And I think other institutes we join with that may support some of the work in those areas, depending upon the emphasis.
Okay, there was another question back in that. Yes, please.
It's an open meeting. If you're interested in that, email me and I'll give you the site where you can go in and find out the details about it. I know it's coming up fairly quick, but I think it's kind of good because what they're doing at that point, it's an open meeting where they're looking at different ideas, different, you know, groups will be there, not only quote-unquote government people, but hopefully people from industry as well as people from, you know, the pediatric community and so forth.
Okay, we'll take one more question.
It can. The reason that this. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Again, that's open because one of the people that's interested, it's also a joint meeting with other federal agencies. For example, FDA is going to be there because they're tasked with what do you do with a device, let's say it's an implanted device, in terms of a neural device, of how do you make sure, what do you need for evidence in that, and so forth. So FDA is very interested in that. But it has, again, to do, it could be a very invasive device that's implanted, or it could be another type of device that's not implanted. Or it could be, you know, an assist device of some sort. For example, a wheeled device that's more, that helps the children get around easier.
Okay, I think we'll stop there and take questions again at the end. And thank you, Luke. Well, kind of in keeping with Ted Conway's wrap up of the talk, I thought the Starfield simulation here. we're going. We're not sure where, but we're going. Let's see here. Hello. Oh, no, now I got to remember my password. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Now, the question is, where's my button?
Now we're in the deep space.
Deep space. Okay. Now, where was it? Conway went and put all this stuff up here, and now I can't find mine. I don't know. Just a minute. I thought I put it on the desk. Oh, did you take your thing out? Oh, there it is. Okay, here we go. Well, first thing I want to ask is, you know, we're always trying in the federal government to convey clearly what's going on. Can you tell me what you think this little gizmo is here? Does anyone want to take a raise their hand? What do you think that is? Okay, microscope and
audio.
Stethoscope. All right. So we're what's the old NIH thing? Bench to bedside. That someone heard that and then went to the drawing board and came up with that. So I just wanted to show you that we're on the job here in Washington. All right. Well, since January of this year, I've moved over to the VA and having fun. Now, my wife said, you're not going to put this slide in, are you? And I said, yes, because over the years, I've developed a real aversion to PowerPoint. And I want to thank the two previous speakers, but somehow when I, as a VA person, go out, I'm supposed to show these VA slides. I'm going to encourage everyone to go on the web and Google Edward Tufte and get a copy of his book, or it's more like a little booklet, The Cognitive Style of PowerPoint. And, you know, for years I didn't like PowerPoint, and I didn't know why. And then I met Edward Tufte, and it was like, you know, a revelation. Now, here's a military parade in Stalin Square in Budapest in April of 1956, and he uses this. Because here's Stalin up on the platform. Next slide, please. Actually, there's a problem with that because Stalin never said please. But anyway, they're saying, you know, things like, why are we having this meeting? The rate of information transfer is asymptotically approaching zero. Anyway, that's my little, and there's no bullet list like Stalin's bullet list. So anyway, all right, just a little, you know, something different. I think Mickey showed this slide yesterday. I do want to say Mickey's been at the VA about a year, and you know, they had a acting in there in that job for 2 years, Bob Ruff, who did a really good job. But Mickey is an eminent neuroscientist. He's still doing a day a week at Penn, and someone with his stature in that position, I think the VA is really positioned to just really go forward here. This was also in Mickey's presentation. I hope you heard kind of a common theme of all the feds, that rather than just doing test tubes, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, make a point here, people, federal agencies, are starting to think about some of these things. Hey, we're talking about research that's got to benefit people. And that, you heard that theme in all the presentations. So when you're writing these grants, you might want to say, well, I'm just going to get a bunch of test tubes dirty and publish papers. My research is going to help people. Okay. This was also in Mickey's thing the other day. I just want to bring it up to show you that Mickey's committed to trying to broadening. If you look, and he mentioned in his talk yesterday that he was being real generous
when he said roughly 8% of the current VA R&D portfolio was in social integration. He wants to try to raise that up, and I was just talking with David here. We've got Sunil Sengupta, who joined the VA about the same time I did, and that's going to be in his purview there. All right. Let's see. Well, the scope, I mean, you know, that's the scope. I want to kind of move along here because we're running out of time. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned in Washington, one of the best things you can do is in a meeting when it's coming to the end to say, I yield my time, you know. So we'll try to get through this. But obviously the VA has traditionally been strong in a number of areas, and Mickey's realized, you know, where we need maybe to do some more work. And so particularly with the conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of stuff has been talked about prosthetics, and I will have a slide about that. But brain injury is really rising to the fore here. So that's something else to think about. Okay. Now, a big difference between the VA program and the programs that folks who preceded me up here is that the VA is an intramural research program. Basically, that means that if you're not a 5'8 salaried VA person, you can't apply. And how do you get to be that? It's usually done at the local level. The VA central office does not mandate, all right, we want some local VA medical center to bring somebody from the university in the VA. It's all done locally, so whatever. You also need, unlike some of the other folks that have spoken, in the VA system, once you're in, you have to do a letter of intent prior to being able to submit an application. Okay? So there are some, and we do have two cycles of review a year. I knew Dr. Cooper was going to be in the audience, so I got my dollar signs up here. All right? Actually, I didn't put dollar signs on, did I? I put little approximation signs. Well, there's a number of different VA mechanisms. The Standard Merit Review Award, which is VA equivalent of an NIHR 01 or a NITR field-initiated grant, about $250,000 a year for 3 years. I have some more slides about our Career Development Award. Also, the Centers of Excellence, roughly comparable to the NITR RERC program, and then the REAP, which I also have a slide on here. Okay. We also have review panels, and do want to just do a little sidebar here that how many of you have ever served on a review panel for a federal agency and come to Washington? All right. Now, see, that's a good show of hands, but really everybody in the room should have raised their hand, because this thing about being competitive, how do you get funded, unless you have been on a couple of peer review panels, you can't know the types of things you need to know to write a successful grant. So when my colleague Ted, David, or Lou, or Joe Pelham there from NIH CSR call you and say, would you be a reviewer? That's an opportunity for you. Yes, it's a lot of work, but if you've not done it before, it's a good opportunity and you ought to do it. Okay, well, whatever. We've got our panels. We've got about at a given time, 370 active awards. Our funding rate happens to be a little better. If you look across the VA, we're a little better. Let's see. The Career Development Award Program, these are basically salary support programs, but other things, and there the award rate's even a little higher, 30th percentile. So these are people that are, now I think we do have a research career scientist, a senior research career scientist in the room, don't we? Do we have any others? Okay, well, to hear about the wonders of that program, Dr. Cooper can tell you all about that. Well, and I heard it's also true that you roll on water. We heard that once in the review panel. Okay. All right. The career program started in 97. There's been over 100 awardees in the program, and that program has been growing. Okay, this is just a list of our centers of excellence. I'm not going to read them all. You can go on the web and find them. But we've got across the board. We've also got these research enhancement award programs. These are like smaller centers of excellence where you've got a number of different projects in these various areas. Again, you can find that on the web. I don't want to go over it. Ew, what do we have here? Aye. Well, I don't know. Somehow we're scrambled. This is the Boston Retina Project, which the VA is also supporting. Just to give you some example, here's Hugh Hare from from the Providence VA and MIT with some of his prosthetics work. This, we kind of stole some stuff out of the Cleveland FES guide there, the little person with all the arrows so that functional electrical stimulation can do. And again, the brain-computer interface, you've heard that theme. John Walpaugh was here with, on the stage with Mickey the other day. A lot of interest in that. And here's, you know, people say, Bob, why did you go to the VA? Well, one of the reasons I went, besides being a veteran, having donated a lot of time over the years, volunteer time to the VA, is DARPA, that's the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, spent in a period of about four, well, we're in the middle of this revolutionizing prosthetics, they spent on the order of magnitude on these prosthetic arms about the annual budget of the VA R&D service. There has never, in my knowledge, been an investment in prosthetics in that amount of time at that amount of money for upper extremity prosthetics. So we're looking at one right now that, and you talk about choice of words, a strap and go. I said, I wonder who made that one up. But anyway, you put the arm on and it doesn't rely on a neural interface, but then somewhere down the road we're going to do that. And DARPA has had two distinct efforts, one at DECA, Dean Kamen's company, and the other at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. There were some congressional hearings in 2004 and another little bump there in 2007 that said if DARPA's going to spend all this money, maybe if they get any arms out of it, the arms ought to go to the VA. Do you think that would be? So that's sort of what's happening now. Whoops. All right, here's the questions, and good, we still have a little time for questions for all of the feds here. It's just 11:30 now, so there's my email. And actually, my telephone at NSF, now Ted has got the number. So even if you have an old telephone book, you know, you'll get the right person, okay? Oh, and I did want to close, you know, you talk about old people in the room. I got my first granddaughter. This is Queen Elizabeth III. And she didn't even have to be a princess first. And we call this first bubbles because here's some little bubbles. And those of you that know American Sign Language, that's why I wanted to show this. This is I love you, all right? And that was not staged or anything like that. But I don't go to any international meetings anymore. I go to Minneapolis about 12 times a year because that's where Her Majesty lives. So I just thought I'd end with that. Now, maybe one or two questions for me, and then we'll open it up to questions from everyone else. And I do want to remind you, as Lou pointed out, we've got Joe Pelham here who works for the NIH Center for Scientific Review. And which study section are you doing now, Joe? Okay. I could, here, I'm going to maybe be a little less cryptic to take the mic here.
It's called MOS F15.
Yeah, what kind of proposals come to that?
Mostly SBIRs in prosthetics and wheelchairs in augmented communication, and we do some R01s in that area also.
Okay. So there's someone else who was not one of our speakers, but who you may want to ask questions to in that regard. With respect to the, all right, any questions for me about the VA?
Just another question, but comment. So this is an arms buildup that's sponsored by the Defense Department?
Yes. And for a change, a good arms buildup. Yes. You know, I was supposed to have a slide. I've only been there since January. Maybe somebody else. There's two. We review proposals in like August, so that probably means you had to have the LOI in. And it seems like we just got the LOIs in March, and then the proposals came in June, and then add 6 months to that, and that's where the other one is. Simple math. All right, anyone else, questions for me on NITER, on the VA? I will not answer any questions about NITER. Okay.
You can say what I can say.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I said to David, do you have a PowerPoint? And he says, no, you know what it's like getting something cleared at NITER. And I said, well, yeah, that's one of the reasons that I kind of moved on, you know, because you could never get anything cleared. And then when I went to NSF, they said, all you got to do is put a disclaimer on. And with the VA, you don't even have to do that. All right. Well, enough about that. Questions for any of our federal counterparts here? You've got us in the room here. You want to know how to get funded? We've been trying to tell you. You want to know what programs we've got? We've been trying to tell you. Do you have specific questions you want to ask of anyone? All right, here and then Rory, yes. Well, the VA used to do that in the days of Dr. Giannini, because I can remember being a young person in academia, all starry-eyed, coming and listening to these people from the VA telling me how to write grants for the VA, you know? But as far as I know, we haven't done it. Ted, and any other, do you do grant writing workshops? NCMR does. Okay. Okay. All right, we'll do Rory and then...
I have a comment.
Oh, a comment.
There's an awful lot available on the web for grant writing tips. There's whole PowerPoint presentations. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's all Boolean logic. It all depends on the keywords you put into a Google search. But if you do it right, it really pops up some very instructional and useful advice.
Say anything more about what Ralph is doing.
Right. No, I can't vouch for Ralph, but I know what the center does. we do go to professional societies and provide, for example, grant working workshops. We also attend professional meetings. And when there's travel funds, we do go to institutions if they have sort of a regional emphasis where they bring faculty in from different areas. So I think one of the most important things, and I think it relates to, again, to what was said before, is you really need to get out to talk to the researchers to find out what's interesting and what's going on. And it's been difficult, obviously, with our restrictions sort of on RMS funds. But what we try to do, based upon invitations, we try to make those rounds, if you would, to speak to different people. And we can put on specific workshops.
Okay. Did you have another question?
Now, on the sheet I passed around, Ralph does both the basic sort of area and he also does career development awards. But we, I mean, mostly because of the system, it's NIH-wide kind of thing, as many of the other program officials do K awards, which are, for those that are not familiar with that technology at NIH, they're basically career awards, similar to the VA awards and so forth, that are done at NIH. And those are for a lot of the students that you're working with that are interested in pursuing research later on. And it's an important, I think, that the system is kind of, you know, an FTK sort of R system where you go from small amounts of funds up through to different awards you sort of go through. And you really should have people, I think, would
actually for all of you, but can you give a couple of examples of the common things that all the great grants do and the pitfalls that the bad grants do?
Okay. Anyone want to tackle that one? Okay.
As far as NSF is concerned, a great proposal is one that gives equal consideration to the technical merit and the broader impact. A lot of scientists have excellent technical merit with respect to the science that they're doing, but they leave out a lot with respect to the broader impact and diversity and all the issues related to who is going to be using their technology and how it's going to be integrated into society. So if you can incorporate that into the proposal, it's going to really strengthen your proposal so that it has a much better chance of being funded. And all of the proposals that are funded do take that into account. But I want to make a comment, too, earlier with respect to the grant writing. The Engineering Directorate, I think it's every 2 years at NSF, has a workshop for students who are in the transition from the end of their PhD into their first year or two of their tenure track position. And one of the programs that they have is grant writing. But it's all the how to survive tenure, how to get into a tenure track position, especially, and it's designed for underrepresented groups. It's designed for women, minorities, and persons with disabilities primarily. So it's how do you survive in an environment, especially in engineering, that's predominantly white male? How do you survive in that type of environment when you're in a minority status?
Oh, we've got Tim Muzio here. I didn't see you in the back. Here, please. We had said earlier on, any feds in the audience want to speak up?
I was hiding till I saw what the audience was like. I came in a little bit late. But in response to grant writing workshops and so forth, a couple of things I would say. The question was raised, what helps you in NIDR? Right now, our big focus is on scientific rigor. We pay a lot of attention to that. You'll see our peer viewpoints reflect that. But more broadly, for grant writing experiences, I've always told people the best grant writing experience you can ever have is to be a peer reviewer. Because your job as a grant writer is to get points. You can have the best idea in the world, but unless you can get those peer review points, you're not going to get the grant. The best way to find out how decisions are made on, reading a proposal to assign the points and to find out the dynamics of discussion among peer reviewers is to be a peer reviewer, because most government agencies rely almost exclusively on peer review rankings. That is, we go right down the slate from the top rated application and work our way down till the money runs out. So if you want a grant writing workshop, be a peer reviewer.
Okay, thank you. And in that regard, I also want to mention you want to target your proposal to the right agency, because I'll just give you one example. When I first came to NSF, my first panel, we got a proposal, and the reviewers, all three of them, independently said, excellent. One of the best proposals I've ever read. I have no negative comments, funded. And I'm, after they got me up off the floor, I said, can you explain that a little more? And they said, well, it really is that good. So, of course, it was the top-ranked proposal. When I called the PI, I said, you're going to get paid. Can you tell me how you put this proposal together? And he said, well, actually, it was through two rounds of review at NIH, but because it was all robotics, the study section was there, and they apparently said it would be more appropriate for NSF. Well, it went to NSF, and boom, got paid right away. So you got to think. I think you heard some of the slants. Like, for example, Ted and I were just talking about cerebral palsy and UCP and whatnot. The VA probably is not going to fund anything in cerebral palsy, all right, for obvious reasons. Now, that's an extreme example, but you want to figure out what look at what the agencies are funding, and say, wow, I got ideas like this. Maybe I ought to send, because folks like you see here, if you call them and say, I want to submit this, and they say, well, don't submit it to me. It's not because they don't like your idea. They're trying to help you find the best place to get funded. If you've got a really good proposal and it matches with the agency, if I see something that, hey, they're going to Stockholm in 2 years, I'll fight hard to get them to submit to me and make sure they get a good review, and or a fair review, I should say. little slip there, but agencies want to fund good science, all right? And program directors will try to bring that about to the best of their, and they'll also fight for more money. Now, I think there was a question over here, and then I see one here.
What are the criteria for being a reviewer?
Responds to light. No. No, obviously, people are going to invite reviewers or ask people to come on study section. Maybe Joe could comment on that. But it's your qualifications. Do you fit the type of proposals that are going to be reviewed?
I just wondered, is it a catch-22?
Oh, that you can't be a reviewer until you've had a grant? Well, I think my experience, well, here, let's talk to somebody who's more experienced than me.
In a way, that's true, but basically, for the small business application that I review in that particular panel, I'm looking for people who are experts in the area of the application that I have to review that round. So if you are an expert in prosthetic, if you work for a small business, I think your chances are pretty good of, you know, if you're interested, that you would be called.
And I'm going to take one more question from Greg in the front row, or wait.
At NSF, we try to balance experienced reviewers with new reviewers. I was on a panel earlier last week, an IGERT panel, which is Integrated Graduate Education Research Training, I think, which is across the board at NSF. It's a very high-profile granting mechanism. And on the panel that I was sitting on, I would say 60% had never reviewed before. They were all assistant professors in new tenure-track positions, but they learn a tremendous amount. So we constantly want new blood coming in to get the training.
Yeah. And I mean, you don't have to, like, have a PhD to necessarily be a reviewer. That's, I think, an important point. All right, we'll take one more question from Greg.
Two quick comments and a question. And the first one is that all of the panels I've ever been on, they're interested in growing reviewers. They're also interested in growing scientists, and they know that this is one of the best ways. So if you think you're too green, apply, because they won't put a whole panel full of people who are green. But as he pointed out, all of the panels I've been on always have people who've never been there before, and so you should be one of them. The second thing is, don't be afraid of project officers. Call them up. They, again, you think that they're the ones who are going to judge you. They actually aren't the ones who judge you. The review panels will judge you. The project officers are the ones who are, again, trying to grow researchers. They're trying to find new people. They're trying to encourage work in their areas. There's nothing you can do better than to get over your fear and go talk with them. The question I had just had to do with when you one of the problems you always have in new areas of research is that your panels are all full of people from old areas. And so, as pointed out, it's always hard to get new stuff funded. So what is it that you do when you get proposals in that, you know, there's like there's nobody on the panel who knows that, but everybody on the panel would like you to know about their area? It makes it really tough for new areas. So what do you do about those things?
Okay. Who wants to take a crack, David? All right, let me give you the mic. But first, Anita, it's Anita, right? Has asked me to announce that the continuing education number is 251. So if you're filling that out, I didn't think you were getting continuing education for this. I mean, it's 251.
Let me give you an example of what we at NIDER, some of us do, many of us do, all of us do, when we see a proposal that we don't really have anybody that we've, say, worked with in the reviewer pool. We do a lot of Google searching. We get on the phone. We look for people who have recently been publishing a lot in the field. We talk to them. We try to recruit them. An example is in the area of BCI. We didn't really have a lot of expertise in our pool of reviewers in the area of BCI, but lo and behold, we went out and we were able to snag a couple of people, not just that area, but who can address other areas as well. So there's always the effort, and I think for the most part the success at making sure that we have at least a reviewer or two of the panel who brings the substantive expertise. Keep in mind, with a standing review panel, you're not going to have seven people who have direct expertise on your content area. You're going to have seven people who are going to give it a fair and thorough review, and they're going to listen to perhaps the content experts for some additional insight, or they're going to listen to the statistician or the methodologist on the panel to make sure that your power analyses and so forth are all right. But that's the advantage of a standing panel with a number of different reviewers from different backgrounds.
Now, I'd just like to make a general comment in terms of program. One of the most exciting areas is this business about paradigm shifts. The problem with paradigm shifts is sometimes in terms of review you run into those difficulties. But the way at NIH in terms of it's handled is you can in a letter, when you submit it, indicate a couple of things. You can put a letter with the proposal, and in that letter you can specify where you want to direct it in terms of the group that might most likely support it, like which institute out of the 25 at NIH would be interested in it. The second thing you can do in there is you can identify the area that you think, you know, you should have some people that are appropriately, you know, have the background. So you can't specify 10 areas, but, you know, one or two you can list and say that a reviewer, you know, people to review this proposal should have that perspective. The other thing you can do, which is a responsibility that's sort of forgotten by many researchers, is you look at the study sections in terms of CSR has a roster on the web or tells which ones of the study sections are there. And they change. I mean, they have changed, I think, Joe and so that. They change in terms of new science coming on board and things. So they're not the same that were there, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago. There may be some different groups. So that's one way. And then if you see a group that sort of is in the area, you certainly, just as you shouldn't be afraid to talk with a program official, you should be able to call up a review official. This is not when the proposal's in, but when you're thinking about it again and ask them, and say, listen, I have a new area and so forth. I'm thinking about submitting it and get some information or input into that. I don't think that's inappropriate. And then, you know, if Joe wants to say something, that's fine. Take this back.
As far as new reviewers, I run two panels. One is a standing committee, and by a standing committee, it means that there are, in this case, 16 regular members. Four of them rotate off every year, and I bring on four new members. But there are always more reviewers around the table than those 16 members because I have more applications, I have specialty areas that I need to get covered science-wise, and so there's always ad hoc reviewers on a panel. The SBIR panel is mostly ad hoc because that's the way they're set up, so I'm always looking for good reviewers in that area. And, you know, depending on the type of applications that come in, this is the type of reviewers that I try to recruit for that particular panel. And Lou is right. For the standing panels, the roster of members is on the web. And also for the ad hoc panels, I believe it's the membership for the last three meetings is on the web. So you can kind of see the type of expertise that is on any panel, and that kind of should be able to guide you on, you know, what panel you want to target your application for.
Okay, thank you. We're about 5 minutes over time, so I just want to close the session, I think, because other people have to get to other places. But I hope that you come away from this meeting knowing that the little representative sample that you've seen here of federal program officers, that we really do care about the field, we're trying to get more money for the field, and that, you know, to come out here on a Sunday afternoon, you know, if that doesn't show we care, I don't know what does. And Hedman, I'm going to talk to you about scheduling these damn things, all right? Okay, well, thank you all for coming, and I think some of us will be up here if you have individual questions. Thank you. Okay, well...